Hey, good morning, gardeners. It's lovely Sunday morning. It's a little sticky out there. Little raindrops on the windshield on the way in, but the temperature's lovely. It's going to be a very nice day to be out in the garden. And that means, you know, if you're out there and you find a problem or you've got a question, you're not sure what should be happening at this time of the year, give me a call. The number's 512-836-0590. Got a simple idea here. Try to help you manage your landscape, your garden, even your houseplants using some organic techniques, because the simple reason is they work. They're easy, and they minimize the impact of the bad things that can happen. So give me a call, and we can talk about some things. You're going to see this really cool thing that happens to plants. You have to look for it, and you will probably find it early in the morning. It's called guttation. Weird word. What it means is basically plants sweat. Seriously. When you have a great swing in temperature, we've been really hot. I'm sure you noticed, but we've been really hot. And when we're really hot, plants will take up a lot of water to compensate. I mean, it's hot. They need the water to survive, etc. But when we have these really drastic swings where we go from hot to, oh, it's really cold, the plant suddenly doesn't need anywhere near the amount of water that it has. And it really doesn't have a way to easily get rid of it. So what happens on a microscopic level on the leaf, you will see these little beads. They'll be almost look like an aphid, except when you touch them, they'll pop and be wet. What that is the process of guttation. There's too much water in the plant, and it will take the excess water, and with some various too many salts and other things that will be in the plant because of the swing in temperature, they will push it out through the stoma, the little breathing ports on a leaf, and you'll have these really tiny little bubbles on the back of the leaf. I can remember we used to see this a lot on spinach plants. It was really an interesting thing to see. And under a microscope, you get this perfect little globe, and you could touch it with a pin or something, and it would bounce a little bit until you pushed hard enough to break the skin, and boom, it would just be like a water balloon. And that's how plants regulate, one of the ways they regulate the amount of moisture that's in them. Just like people, we use it as a cooling process. Plants use it as a method of balancing out the chemistries that are occurring within the plant itself. So there's too much water, it sweats it out. So just one of those cool little things that we see in the swings of temperature that we get around here. You will probably, not for sure, it depends on how much it warms up this week. We're probably going to see cases, too, where you get a little rush of yellow leaves. Now, too much water can cause the leaves of a plant to turn yellow. So we're watering based on a high temperature. Plants taking in a lot of water. Suddenly we get the drop in temperature. Well, the plant doesn't need as much water, and suddenly the soil around it, you know, it's got a lot of water in it because it was hot, but now it's not hot anymore. So that water's not draining or evaporating as fast, and that is one of the conditions that can make the leaves of your plant look yellow. So lots of things happen when we get these huge swings in temperatures. There's all kinds of internal processes that are messed up. We get totally different external conditions because, hey, it's not hot anymore. So these are some of the interesting things we're going to be observing going on in the garden. We had callers yesterday mention that they have various Texas trees that reliably turn color every year in the fall, you know, the classic beauty that we see here in Texas. Well, this year, we may not be seeing it as well. Because of that high heat, because of the lack of rain, the stresses that occurred on the tree, we may see them go from green to brown instead of from green to the yellows and the reds and oranges that we would normally see. It's a stress condition. It's disappointing. There's no doubt about it. I love when my landscape turns colors. You get all these wonderful, wonderful looks on the trees that grow here. This year may not be as nice. It's okay. Your plants are fine. It's just a normal reaction to conditions they're not happy with. But it's something we'll see. It's not a big deal. It's, like I said, disappointing. But this is kind of one of the effects of the swings in the weather that we can get here in Texas. Some of the other things you may see is you have to watch your blooming. That's something that we're going to get the cooler weather now, finally. You're going to see bigger blooms. Roses, you know, here in Texas in the spring, you get a rose bloom and it's, oh, I don't know, 3 inches across. But in the summer, that same plant is blooming, but those blooms aren't anywhere near as big. That's, again, a stress factor. When we get back in the cooler weather, you're going to see those blooms start looking great again. So, hey, you know, we got all these trade-offs. It's never all good or all bad when we get the weather events. I do want to say, though, was outside yesterday doing some work. And my wife came out and said, hey, you got to look. And sure enough, we had three monarchs, southbound monarchs, come through. They were enjoying some salvia. Had my Greg's Mist flower out. It was blooming, of course. They stopped through. They got some food, some rest, and kept going. So the monarchs should be arriving. The other night in Oklahoma, one of the weather stations was able to show a wave, like a front coming through, and it looked just like a weather front, except it was monarchs. They do like the bats do down here. They make enough of a radar echo that we could see it. And they were in the panhandle right before this cold snap really made it down here. So you should be seeing the winds pushing them south now. So go out and enjoy. The ones we saw look like they had just hatched. Such beautiful colors on them, and away they go, heading south. So check it out. This is one of the things we get to enjoy in the fall. You should be seeing them, just loving your flowers in the garden right now. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. We're coming up on the first break. Give me a call. The number's 512-836-0590. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Let's go to the phone. This is Gail. Good morning, Gail. What can I help you with?
I'm having trouble with my vegetable garden with root knot nematodes.
Welcome to Texas. Excuse me. Welcome to the South. From about just a little bit east of California all the way through the Carolinas, nematodes are an issue in the soil.
Okay. I've tried marigolds. I've tried clear plastic solarization, and last year I planted Elbon rye, which helped, but I'm still having trouble. Is there anything else I can do?
No, not really. Here's the deal. They're a living creature, microscopic. There are good guys in the nematode family, and of course there are bad guys. Every time there's moisture in the soil, these critters can move in the soil. So if where you're growing touches the ground, you have an in-ground bed, there's no way to ever put up a barrier that would prevent them from coming from uphill or prevent them from coming. You stick a shovel in the ground, you know, in a different place on your property, and then you use the shovel in your garden bed. You can transfer them that way. They can go to a pretty fair depth and come up from the bottom of the bed. They're always in the soil. Now, the steps you took, if you are fairly consistent with them, like every season, try to plant the Elbon rye. Make sure that you're putting in a ton of marigolds, which actually are an effective method of repelling some of the nematodes. But you just have to do it all the time. There is no There's no single process that will permanently take care of it. Now, there is one thing, and it would be great if we had it here in the States, but it's pretty expensive and, for that reason, kind of impractical to use. There is a product called neem cake. And what it is, it's the leftover part when they take the seed from neem trees and crush it to get neem oil.
Oh, okay.
The neem cake is known to be a pretty decent nematicide. It can chase out or kill the root knot nematodes. But to get a sufficient quantity to manage a bed is, you know, it's shipped from overseas. It's not really produced in the States. You need a lot of it for a even relatively small area, and it would give you great coverage, but like I said, it's getting a hold of enough of it and being able to afford it.
Right.
So it is a good one. There's one last thing that you can do, and it's fairly well documented in its effectiveness. The product Actinovate, which is a bacterium, has been shown to reduce the number of eggs that are produced or successfully hatch when we're talking nematodes. So you take a little bit of the Actinovate, you mix it with a gallon of water, you shake it up really good, and you drench a garden bed with it. And you do this maybe once a month, and you can reduce the number of eggs that are laid. Now, the adults that are there aren't affected by it, but it has some process that breaks down the life cycle and makes it difficult for them to reproduce. So if I'm using all of these steps, I can get some fairly decent control. But there's no permanent, and we don't have one that's like, you know, if I just do this one thing, it will give me one season with no nematodes. We sure would love to find that process, but we ain't figured it out yet.
So use the Actinovate once a month?
Yeah, you can.
All winter, too?
Yes. As long as the ground isn't frozen, the nematodes are still there. They're just not as active. And the Actinovate, if I remember the instructions for the nematode control, it was like a teaspoon of the material in a gallon of water, and that gallon of water was sufficient to cover something like 400 square feet.
Oh,
now, you have to check and make sure that data's current and that recipe's right. But it was like, well, that's pretty simple, you know, just a gallon of water and spread it over a garden bed. I can do that easy. So that is one more tool you have to help.
Now, would the beneficial nematodes help also?
Nope.
Okay.
There are predator nematodes. There are ones that hunt other nematodes. But there's such a blend of them. And part of the problem is here in Texas, the type of soil we have, the kind of temperatures that we get, only certain ones of the nematodes live here. So the one that might eat root knot nematodes, it doesn't live here. So even if I had some, I couldn't like toss it in there and hope they'd work because it wouldn't survive.
Okay. I sure appreciate the information.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah. Gail points out a problem we have in the South. And like I said, it's from just east of California all the way across the South up into the Carolinas. It's nematodes. There's plenty of good ones. There's plenty of bad ones. And they're just something that are particularly difficult to manage. Making sure that you are rotating your beds. Making sure that you plant a crop like Elbon rye, which is effective at putting... The rye releases a chemical from its roots that repels the nematodes. So does marigolds. The products like neem cake, the Actinovate, there's a couple of other nematode products. None of them are inexpensive, unfortunately. But all of these things combined can be worked out to help reduce the impact of nematodes. So what are the nematodes? Well, when you pull your tomatoes up this year, you're going to look at the tomato plant, and if you look at the roots of the tomatoes, you're going to find it looks like your tomato root swallowed a bunch of golf balls, or I guess pearls would be a better view. They will be these little nodules on the root, and what it is the nematode stung it, made it swell up, and it reduces the root's ability to feed the plant. You get really poor harvests. Let's go to the phone. This is Sue. Good morning, Sue. What can I help you with?
Good morning. I'm getting ready to plant dwarf fruit trees in my backyard, zone 8 fruit trees. And my question for you is, do I have to begin with a, if I would like organic fruit, do I have to begin with a USDA organic tree itself? Or can I buy any dwarf tree and get organic fruit if I don't use herbicides and pesticides?
Okay. First, the answer to your question. You do not have to buy an organic tree to get organic fruit. Understanding that when you put a fruit tree in the ground, it's going to be a few years before you actually get a harvest. If you get any fruit the first year in the ground, it'll be amazing, and you really shouldn't let it do that because it's stressful on the tree. So knowing that it's going to take a couple or 3 years to get to the point that it's making fruit, you can put any kind of tree you want in the ground. And from that point, if you treat it organically, the rules for the organic certification program says you have to go 3 years with no chemicals.
Oh, okay.
So if you go 3 years and you treat it only organically, and that third year you start harvesting fruit, congratulations, you've got an organic fruit.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call, ma'am.
Bye.
That's one of the things, folks. No matter how you start, it's generally considered that 3 years' worth of organic techniques makes the farm, makes the fruit, makes the garden organic. So it's a simple way to get to that point. When you buy it and it doesn't have that organic sticker, doesn't matter. It's how you treat it from that point on as to what kind of food you get. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. We're coming to the bottom of the hour. We're going to have to take a break for the news. Give me a call. The number's 512-836-0590. We'll be back after this. Welcome back, everybody. You know, I want to go on a little bit more about the nematodes. I know sometimes I have to really express a lot of really bad news, but we need to be aware of what they are. Nematodes are a they're not all microscopic. The smallest ones are. The largest known nematode in the world, about 8 inches long. It's in South America. It's a segmented worm. What they do is they cruise through the soil, and some nematodes infect insects. For example, the beneficial nematodes crawl inside an insect larva or egg, they multiply, they eat from the inside, they burst out, no more insect. So that's a good thing. Beneficial nematodes attack fire ants and fleas and grubs and things like that. The bad nematodes are things like hookworm, which we don't ever want to get in us or our dogs. Root knot nematodes, they're of form of what's called a stinging nematode. This nematode crawls up to a root, it stings it, and it has the method of breaking the skin and sucking out nutrients from the root. But the process of doing so causes the root to swell in that area. Just like if you were stung by a bee or a wasp, the spot you get stung gets really hard, swollen. Well, that's what's happening to the root, but it never goes away. So the root is basically being strangled. Everything from the point of the sting to the end of the root, well, that's useless now. Anything that root collects, it's never going to make it to the plant. So we have a plant growing, and the root knot nematodes come in, and effectively they're trimming the roots off of the plant. In a really bad case, they can reduce the roots to the point that the plant can just fall over. Okra, peppers, eggplant, tomatoes, they are really susceptible to root knot nematodes. You'll even find them on beets. The fine hair roots on the outside of a beet, they can get nematodes. They move through the soil on a surface of water. So every time it rains in one place and the water runs downhill, the nematodes, they're doing a cowabunga surf job all the way down to the lowest spot. So they move through the soil so easily. There's not a lot we can do about them. There are products. I mentioned the Actinovate breaks some of the life cycle. It makes the eggs less likely to hatch. It means there's fewer of them to deal with. Marigolds Elbon rye. This isn't the rye grass. This is called cereal rye, a grain rye. They give off chemicals from the roots that also repel nematodes. There are products that are full of saponins, which is a form of soap. And there are products like neem cake, which is a nematicide. It releases a chemical that stops the nematodes also. There are all these steps that you can take to battle the root knot nematodes. The other thing that you can do, and it's too late in this season to do so, you're probably not going to find tomato start somewhere where you're going to be able to be successfully putting in a start and getting a yield yet. But there are tomatoes that will have a string of letters behind it, like VFNT. Those letters mean that the tomato is resistant to various things. The V stands for verticillium, a usually fatal disease of the tomato. The F stands for fusarium, which is another disease, and there are several forms of fusarium. So you may see VFFNT. The N stands for nematodes. It means that the tomato is resistant. It doesn't mean nematode-proof, but it means it is less damaged by nematodes. So being in the South, it's an advantage to increase your harvest by going out and finding tomatoes that have N in their name that makes them nematode resistant. You should be able to get a better crop out of them. All things being equal, and we're only judging for the nematodes, you should be able to get a better crop out of them. These are not engineered plants. There are certain varieties of tomatoes that are naturally resistant, so we're going to crossbreed them with other varieties of tomatoes to try to come up with one that is nematode resistant. We even do this with peach trees. Almost all peaches in at least central Texas, if not all of Texas, are on a rootstock called NemaGuard. It is peach tree roots that are resistant to the nematodes so that you can get a decent peach harvest. So this is a common practice. It is one of the easiest ways to deal with the nematodes because it is very, very difficult to get them out of your soil. Now, notice I mentioned that they move around on the soil because they're surfers and they just travel wherever the water goes. So that means in a containerized garden, or in a raised bed that doesn't touch the ground, I could keep nematodes out because I'm providing the soil. I fill it with a soil. If I take the soil and it's bagged and it's some good potting soil and I fill the bed with that, there shouldn't be nematodes in it. So I should be able to grow stuff and not have the risk of nematodes. I could use garden soil so long as I put it out all summer and sterilized it under clear plastic or black plastic to kill all the nematodes that would be in it, to sterilize the eggs, and then use that in the container so I eliminate the nematodes as an issue. But when I do these things, I have to remember I cannot stick my tools in the soil, in the regular ground, and then stick them in that container because even the smallest piece of soil can transfer root knot nematodes, and among the other bad ones, into your containerized garden and you're back where you started. Now I got to clean the soil again to get started to get the nematodes out. So that is one of our curses of living in Texas. It's a annoying pest. It affects a large number of crops, including some fruit trees. And the best we can ever do is to try to plant crops that are resistant. It is possible to work your soil and do all those kind of steps that I mentioned and really work hard to try to keep the nematodes at bay, but it is not ever going to be a 100% successful process of I have eliminated the nematodes and I will never see them again. That just will not happen. So consider those steps when you're creating your garden. Swap your plantings frequently. Plant crops in off seasons that repel the nematodes. use those products and make sure that if you're buying a start, that you look for starts that have nematode resistance. You'll be much more successful in your garden. Folks, we're coming up on a break. This is Gardening Naturally. Give me a call, 512-836-0590. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. So, looks like it's going to be a lovely morning. A great day to be outside in the garden. Lots of things to think about. This little cold front was just a sort of gentle reminder. We're still going to be in warm temperatures for a while. We're not going to suddenly have to wrap everything up and worry about stuff freezing. There's quite a bit of gardening season left yet. But this is a good reminder for you. There's nothing worse than you get home from work, it's dark out, it's misting or raining out, the wind's howling, and now you remember that the weather guys told you that it's going to freeze tonight, and your garden is still full of all those crops that you'd really like to see continue. And even more insulting is when it's, oh, well, we're going to touch freezing for a few hours, and then we're going to be in the 70s again for the next 2 weeks. So start thinking about preparing your garden. Not the garden itself, but the tools you're going to need to keep it warm. Have you got hoops that go in the ground? Go ahead and put them out now. Nothing wrong with that at all. So you get them out there and you don't have to use them. Okay, don't. But you don't have to try to find them at the last minute. Start now. It's going to be a nice day. This is a great day to get the cold weather gear ready. I used to lay my row cover, which is super effective at giving some protection. I used to lay my row cover out now. I'd be right at the edge of the garden bed, all bundled up, so that when we got closer, I didn't have to go find it. I didn't have to see if there was any holes torn in it. Made sure I had all the clamps and clips and all the stuff that I needed to be able to secure it over the bed. Maybe you need to look at what beds do you need to cover. That's one that's a planning problem. We talk about this not just with cold weather, hot weather, but also with water needs. If I have a garden bed and I only have one, it's worth my time to try to go, well, let's put the really tender cold stuff at one end of the bed. That way, maybe I don't have to cover the whole thing. If I have more than one garden bed, well, then that makes it super easy. One bed can be full of all the things that can handle the cold weather, like kale and broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower. They don't mind the cold. Neither do beets or carrots. They'll be just fine. But those peas, that's another story. Those are probably going to need some protection. And you know, peppers, they're going to have to be protected. Maybe even some of your tender herbs. So put the stuff that can't take the cold in the same bed. That way you only have one thing to cover, if you even have to bother covering them. The stuff that can handle the cold, well, you may still need to have a cover for them, but you're not going to have to do it as early as you would other crops. So keep them together. Just like we recommend, plants that need a lot of water should be with plants that need a lot of water. Plants that are more dry, like our rosemaries or lavenders, should be in a bed with other plants that are very dry. Because when you try to find a happy middle ground, no one is happy. You can't put mint and rosemary in the same container because one wants to be super wet and one wants to be super dry, and there is no middle. They're not going to work it out together. And somebody's going to fail in that equation. So your garden should be set up the same way. Rather than having to go, gosh, I got to cover four different beds because each bed has a plant or two in it that may freeze, put all the freezable plants in one bed. I only have to cover one bed. It's less work. It's much more efficient. And it really doesn't affect the production of the plants. So this just means less time out there in the cold blowing wind and, the rain and having to worry about the plants. So take the extra step as you're planning your garden out. If you haven't planted your fall garden yet, now's a great time to take this into consideration. It's less work. But it's also true if you've already got your garden in place and you're well on your way for the fall garden, start getting your covers ready. Milk jugs, if you still get the plastic milk jugs, make great covers. Cut the bottom off. You can set them over the top of a plant. Da-da-da, you have an instant little greenhouse for that plant. At night, you put the lid on so that it holds the heat in there. And then in the daytime, when it gets warm, come out in the morning, pop the lid off. That keeps them from getting too hot in there. 5-gallon buckets work great, folks. You can cover a lot of plants with a 5-gallon bucket, even the taller ones. I can get a 5-gallon bucket over my pepper plants. That way I can keep them warm enough. One very, very important consideration when it comes to covering plants, regardless of what you are using for the cover, whether it's a bucket, a sheet of plastic, or frost cloth, the material you're using should not touch the plant. When it gets cold enough, that cover is going to keep heat in, and it's going to keep the plant many degrees warmer than the outside air. That's a good thing. However, the cover itself can still freeze. And if your plant is touching that cover, that means the plant is going to freeze where it's in contact. So leave an air gap. Do your best to cover the plant with as small a gap as possible. You don't want it 4 feet above the plant because that's where all the heat's going to be, way at the top and not at the bottom. But you don't want the cover to touch the plant. You can freeze those leaves that are in contact, and that's going to damage the plant. So keep those things in mind. When it's 70 degrees out is the perfect time to prepare for when it may be freezing out, because you won't have to be outside in the cold to do it. Plan your garden properly. If you're just now putting your fall garden in, great. It's a perfect time to do so. But cold plants with cold plants, and plants that can not handle the cold should be with plants that can't handle the cold. It'll be less work on your part when it comes to covering things up and trying to extend your garden season. And speaking of which, if you've got a hothouse or one of those little miniature greenhouses, you're going to have to watch it carefully. We're still going to get warm temperatures and bright sunshine, and those things can go over 100 degrees in a hurry. So if you're using a cold frame to start your seeds for the fall, you're going to have to make sure that you can open that up and let the heat out, or they'll cook those seeds yet. There's plenty of heat, plenty of sunshine for it to be too hot. Folks, this is Gardening Naturally. We're going to take an end to our first hour and make a break for the news. Give me a call. The number's 512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-512-